something in here with us.
We have no weapons of any kind.
Let's start it.
It's here!
Although edited for television, tonight's thriller contains scenes of suspense and violence which may be unsuitable for young viewers. Parental discretion is advised.
It's going to be an interesting approach on this one because we're covering so much material and it's not all going to be in one place. So my thinking is that we actually start with Alchemy, since that's a full miniseries and should ideally be a full episode of the show, and then progress from there.
Okay. Cool.
Excerpt from Rumble writer John Arcudi, the Horror News Network interview, written by Nick Banks, published December 22nd, 2017. Horror News Network. You have worked on a number of comics based on popular science fiction and horror films. Do you have a favorite series? Is there a film or television property that you would love to write that you haven't had the chance to? Arcudi. My favorite series has nothing to do with the property, but my collaborator, Richard Corbin. We worked together on Aliens Alchemy, and to get a chance to work with just about the greatest living comics artist was incredible. It would have been nice if I could have written a better script for him, but that doesn't take away from the sheer joy and awe of the experience. He's a master of the form, and he's the reason I was attracted to comics in the first place. So it's literally a dream come true. Doesn't happen often.
So I guess the first question, did you pick up Alchemy when it was coming out, or was that something you came to later on?
A lot of these Aliens books I realized after the fact. So the Mondo books I picked up as they were coming out. The Rizzo books, which we'll talk about at some point, I picked up as they came out. With Alchemy, I don't think I was on board with Corbin at that point. So despite the fact that the covers are clearly amazing, I wasn't there yet, because I think you may be able to correct me, but I think this preceded Hellblazer, which most people think of as being like his first return to American comics before all the Marvel stuff and Hellboy stuff and all of that. But I think Alchemy actually came before that Hellblazer
story. That seems familiar, because I'd forgotten that Corbin had ever had a run on Hellblazer. I might not have handled those when I had it at my shop, which means that that was way after this one, because I do remember this coming through my first shop back in the day, if I recall correctly. What was your first exposure to Corbin?
I had that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles color issue he did for ages. I don't know why I picked it up. I never had any other Turtles comics. I saw that one, picked it up because it kind of fascinated me, and this was at like 17 or 18, I guess, and then I left it unread for years. And I think when I actually finally read it, it was because of the writer, not because of Jan Stranad, and not because of the art. So that would have been my first exposure to him, although I didn't read it. And then the chronology of House on the Borderland, that adaptation that he did for Vertigo, and then the Hellblazer. I forget which came first, but it would have been one of those two. House on the Borderland was a recommendation from a friend, and Hellblazer I was always interested in when it looked interesting. Brian Azzarello was coming onto it from 100 Bullets, a writer that I find to be a bit kind of hit and miss, because 100 Bullets was great. I read the Hellblazer run and it was tremendous. Yeah, either one of those was the thing that made me start paying attention to Corbin.
I was familiar with him well before then. I had exposure to Heavy Metal magazine. I had a little exposure to his Warren work, but mostly it was Heavy Metal, especially the cartoon. They adapted his character Den to the cartoon.
Yeah.
And actually, Eclipse put out a series of Den books sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, and so I gotta check some of that stuff out. Definitely a unique artist. Coming into this episode, I expected you were gonna be chastising me and being like, if I wasn't a full-on worshiper of Corbin, you'd be like wagging your finger at me or something. It was odd to hear you being the first one going out saying, you know, not necessarily my taste. I definitely like Corbin, but it's also a situation where I'm expecting him to do underground stuff. I'm expecting him to do Heavy Metal type stuff. So it's always a little weird for me when he's doing something that's supposed to be in the mainstream. And I'm coming off of doing an episode on Aliens Batman, and here's Bernie Wrightson doing this.
Yeah.
And it's hard not to see that as slumming. And I'm looking at the dates. This is the late 90s. We were still in the, is this industry going to survive the 20th century situation? And so I have to feel like that had something to do with compelling Corbin to do an Aliens tie-in book. And I realized they paired him with John Arcudi, who is a respectable writer, less so probably then than he would become, but somebody who isn't just like like, it's like Ron Mars, you know, it's like, oh God, I'm working with some comic book guy who does superhero stuff all the time. And the story itself definitely plays to things that I think Corbin would be on board with, especially all the questioning of religion and stuff. But it still definitely feels like Corbin is also slumming working on a movie tie-in in the late 90s, probably for the coin.
In terms of first getting acquainted, you know, I worked in Gosh Comics in London. We had as good a European comic section as you could find when hardly anybody was publishing European comics. So we had spotty collections of Den, I think it was Catalan who published them, as well as publishing like awful translations of Hugo Pratt comics. We had a basement full of bits and pieces of Mobius, and I don't know why I'm including Den in there. I think it's probably because it's published by Catalan. So I saw them, but because there's a few things like this in my comic collecting where if I never came across a full run at any time, I never dived in. I'm not someone who's going to happily pick up issue 20 hoping to find issue 1 to 19 at some point. If I can get them all in one go, maybe pay a little bit more, I'd much rather do that. I sort of saw Corbin and I saw Den, this kind of peculiar looking art with his huge floppy wangs.
all the bits tearing up in his stories, that's for sure.
I did see it, and from that I had the impression that I just wasn't much of a fan, to be honest. But once I was on board, I was all the way in. Like, I think I've got everything from a point in time onwards, you know? This Aliens mini, I think it is pretty primo, even down to the very peculiar and particular colours. We can get to that in a second, but my Corbin love is deep at this point. I can get that it's not to everybody's taste, but if you've seen the right stuff, then I think it's hard to argue with, you know?
For me, he's never one of my top 10 guys or anything. He always felt like he was an artist that belonged to other people. Like, I know my boy Mr. Fix-It loves Corbin because he loves all that heavy metal type stuff. And for me, again, he's a guy who should be doing the underground stuff, the sci-fi, and the fantasy stuff along those lines, the heavy metal lines. What gets me with him is you can definitely see his DNA in a lot of artists that I have a greater affection for. Simon Bisley specifically comes to mind. And both of them, their strength is still in, like, they do sci-fi, they do horror, they do fantasy, but it's a meathead version of it oftentimes. Or at least that's the strength. Like, I went back and I looked at the Den stuff that was done for, I think it was Eclipse, where he was going much deeper into the lore and really moving past the actual character of Den and building more into the world, which I'm sure you've read at this point from what you're telling me. And that's much more serious stuff. I'm not attracted to that. I read it, but I'm not really attracted to that because the things I like about Corbin do tend to be the big heavy metal album cover elements of his work. And I do like it when he does more political type stuff. Again, like this story is critical of zealotry. Not necessarily religious zealotry, although it definitely trends that way, but ultimately maybe not as much as you would think at the beginning of the story. And I think he's good for that kind of thing. I don't necessarily want to see him on anything that's more mainstream. Like, Aliens is about as mainstream as I would want to see from him. And again, because of the level of violence in this work, it suits his strengths. But I wouldn't necessarily want to see him do like a Colonial Marines miniseries after this or something like that. It's like, it needs to be a little weird, a little off the beaten path for it to feel like it's appropriate for him. But what I will say is, especially when it comes to his colors and his colors, I tried to watch a little bit of a cartoonist kayfabe where they talked about the techniques that he uses, and I just couldn't get through it. I kind of skipped through it a little bit because I can only stomach so much of the self-prostitution before it just like wears me down. But do you have any insights on how he accomplishes that look? Because it's almost like you'll look at something like a cell phone, like especially a flip phone, and you see how somebody was watching Star Trek in the 60s, and because of that, they geared toward actually creating the cell phone that works, that essentially is the same as a communicator from Star Trek. Yeah. I feel like sometimes you look at the Richard Corbin stuff, and also the Angus something, the guy who also worked
with Angus McKee.
Angus McKee. I feel like programmers were looking at their work, and that's how CGI came about. It's like they worked to get to a place where they could do Richard Corbin work digitally. Do you have any insights on how he accomplishes his incredible looks, especially on these covers?
Yeah, so there was an art book. I can't remember. There were several Corbin art books, and there was one that I had and then sold in a moment of weakness. No regrets so far, but a little bit maybe. Within that book, there was a two-page thing that explained how he does his colors. He colored them somewhat traditionally, and then he would print them out, and then he would paint over them again, and then he would print them. And so it's just this kind of layering, like he was layering and layering the colors, which is how he ended up at that intensity. I think on these covers for Alchemy, they're digital at this point, and he's just ahead of the game with digital. But on the painted stuff, like like the painted, the Den covers and the Warren comics and things. It's all this very specific technique. I'm sure I or you can find, there's a couple of pages that explain it. This weird thing of layering, printing, super involved, like crazy amount of effort to get to the coloring effect that he had. But the effect is unarguable, I think. Like you say, I know exactly what you mean. He set a bar so high that it was just kind of how do we achieve the same with whatever computer stuff we're coming up with.
Yeah, and you look at the background of this first cover with all the textures, the pebbles and everything, and you contrast that against the alien with the rich, heavy secretions. There's just a lot going on there. There's an incredible illusion of depth there.
I think he was quick to adapt his manual style to digital. So while Liquid Color were putting lens flares all over Battle Chasers or whatever, Richard Corbin was busy just coming up with this kind of rich, bonkers artwork. I just love it. And when I look at the stuff that he did earlier manually, even having a vague insight into, not a vague insight, I've read the words, I just don't understand how he knew that it would print like that. You know, it's just, ironically, it's a kind of alchemy, you know?
Right.
So I look at the older stuff and it still boggles my mind that he was the only one doing it.
It's a nice logo too. The actual Alchemy logo, it evokes what it's stating it is. And I don't think I've seen that specific logo type anyplace else.
I've got to say, like, one of the things, reading through these, I get a similar kind of Proustian rush from looking at Dark Horse comics of this era, as most people probably do reading 70s and 80s Marvel comics and seeing adverts for Ugly Balls or whatever it was like. But I'm reading these Dark Horse comics and seeing adverts for the other Dark Horse comics that were coming out at the time. It feels, for me, that was like a real golden age. At the time, they were doing Legend, and they had these various things going on, but it all seems more than any other publisher, Image included, they were the creator focused publisher. I can understand how they got Corbin to do this, if they got Miller doing something else and Mignola doing something else, and it feels like it a really vital place to work. Back of issue one, you got an advert for Mignola and Pat McEwan's Zombie World, which was one of the best comics of that year. So I love this particular period of comics and Dark Horse comics, and I think their production values, like on that logo, like you say, were part of that mix.
Well, I would say in this time period, certainly the two publishers you look to actually support talent and allow them to manifest their visions would have been Dark Horse and Vertigo. But with Vertigo, you would always have to deal with some of the DC politics. And even if they were good in 1997, within a couple or 3 years of that, they weren't. So Dark Horse was consistent for a long time. And obviously they've inspired some loyalty because you've still got people publishing with them decades after the fact. You mentioned Mike Mignola. He's been with them since the early 90s. He's barely strayed from them in all that time period, so they must feel pretty comfortable. And especially when you mention Image definitely gave you an opportunity to publish your work. I would not say they supported anybody. There were no free rides at Image, and they could be pretty ruthless about running people off if they didn't feel like they were helping Image and the brand. So yeah, I would definitely say that if you were looking for a supportive place for talent, somebody who's going to make sure they got paid and got projects, and they, I think Dark Horse would be the place to be in this time period.
Yeah, there was a Scott Morse interview. I can't remember if it was fairly early cartoonist kayfabe, maybe. But there was a Scott Morse interview that I saw somewhere where he was talking about working on Sam and Twitch for McFarlane. And obviously McFarlane at this point was probably more focused on the toys. So dropped the ball and didn't realize that Scott Morse was going to be doing Sam and Twitch. But when he saw it, he was like, the fuck is this? And like said to Scott Morse, like, what are you doing here? Kind of thing, you know? And I just love the idea that Scott Morse doing like Soul Wind and Little Grey Man suddenly ends up doing Sam and Twitch with Mark Andreyko, and Todd McFarlane is just like, sorry, who let these guys in? So he clearly wasn't into like the Jim Valentino part of the Mark, the Image comics, you know?
I don't think that you and I have talked about any John Arcudi stories so far in these discussions. When did you first have experience with that writer?
That's a good question. Probably Mask Comics with Doug Mankey, or maybe some of his odd DC bits that he's done over the years. I don't know. Interesting. I'd be curious to look at the chronology. Basically, from the first I read of his stuff, I was on board. Like, there was a definite voice, and I like writers with a voice, even if I'm more artist-focused in general. I like when I can kind of identify what a writer's bringing that makes them different to other writers. There are, like, obviously won't go into it, but there are plenty of writers who I love who have a specific thing, and John Arcudi's thing just seems to be kind of smart and kind of funny. And in fact, I'm going to say major bummer. That's probably the first thing that I was fully on board with. And I've kept an eye on him here and there over the years. So the Mask stuff I would have read after Major Bummer, but Major Bummer was just brilliant. It was a part of that, another kind of renaissance at DC going on at very similar times to this Dark Horse one, of lots of offbeat comics that seemed very generous to creators and giving them flexibility before they reined it all in and went back to normal in about 2000.
Did you catch the short story they did for the Image Anthology?
Who?
The creative team on Major Bummer. They can't use the name Major Bummer because DC has the trademark on that, if I recall correctly, but the actual characters appeared in a story in Image Anthology, and I suspect, I've been wondering, because you've got all this Ghost Machine thing going on with Geoff Johns, and Monkey was a longtime collaborator with him, but so far there's been no mention of him having anything to do with that project. My wondering, especially since I don't think I've seen him do much for DC lately, I'm wondering if they're working on new Major Bummer stuff under the new title, and that we're going to be hearing about that coming out of Image in the relatively near future at this point, because the anthology story was last year, or maybe even 2022, so it's been a little bit since I've heard from either one of those guys in that regard, but in general, I don't think I've seen anything by Monkey in a while, so I'm wondering if they're stockpiling material for that.
Well, Monkey did that big Swamp Thing mini with Jeff Lemire. He did an oversized Black Label Swamp Thing thing, and he's currently doing a Jason Aaron Batman in Space story miniseries. So he is still doing stuff at DC, and that he's inking himself. Unfortunately, it's colored by David Barron, so it looks awful. That guy's rough. But despite being like really detailed, I think Monkey's pretty fast, so I'm not discounting what you're suggesting, and I'd love the idea of more Major Bummer, because that was a particularly quite a unique world. I've got to say, I dropped the ball on that anthology, but it feels like every issue, oversized, overpriced, and every issue had a little chunk of gold in it, and it's just quite annoying, you know? When I look at six issues of an anthology, or in this case, 10 or whatever, and I could reasonably chop it down to about two issues of really good stuff, it kind of pisses me off to spend £8 an issue, or, you know, $10 an issue for, I mean, what, 10 issues, $10? It's like $100 worth of anthology, and you're ultimately getting about, what, 60 pages worth of gold. So I love a good anthology, but they're very few and far between. So I need to look out for that, basically.
When I was a kid, anthologies always bummed me out because they often wouldn't go anywhere. You have these little short stories where it's like, well, that was a good one in the issue, and the other two maybe weren't. And it's like, why, like you said, why am I buying the whole book when I only maybe like one of the stories? But for some reason, after the turn of the millennium, I just kind of got into the idea of, I want to sample a more variety. I want to read more, you know, just different stuff.
Yeah.
And so I started buying every anthology, like virtually any anthology that was being offered for a period there. You know, Dark Horse Presents, I think Asylum Press was doing one for a little while there. Indie Comics, just all this random stuff. And so when Image announced one, I'm like, okay, I'll go for that too, especially since it was an anniversary, and because they were going to be digging into their old characters. And there is stuff growing out of that. And I did find that the anthologies, some anthologies I'll start reading and I'll kind of start to lose interest and they'll start to pile up. I stuck with Image Anthology throughout, and like you said, most issues had at least one or two good strips in them, and a lot of them are becoming something. Like, I'm excited because I thought that Joe Casey playing around with Dutch was just going to be a little goof in this anthology, and now he's like bringing back essentially, you know, serial number filed off Youngblood, you know, and he has an ongoing series coming out of that. So it's like, oh, this is actually a thing. It's first, it's a serial, and now it's a mini series, and now it's going to be an ongoing series. They just had a lot of stuff that, for my interest with the Image stuff, they satisfied me, even though I know the price point was high. And of course, I benefit because I'm in the country it's being produced in, and I'm getting this stuff at a substantial discount, so it didn't hurt my pocketbook as much as it probably hurt yours.
Yeah, I've picked up a couple as back issues when I've, having realized that there's stuff in them, and that major, I believe there's one issue that for some reason goes for silly money, and I think that reason that is that it's got like a James Tinian thing in it, and so it's got all that kind of, this could be the next whatever, like all of his titles are the same, right? Like
the
next boy by the lake in the well with the knife.
Right. The ghost thing that he's doing for Distillery, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I picked up a couple of issues because there's stuff in them, but it's because I've managed to find them at a reasonable price on eBay.
Yeah.
But it looks like getting a complete set is probably going to be prohibitive, particularly because of that Tinian story. But talking of aliens, did you see the Oni anthology, Xeno, X-I-N-O?
I don't think so, no. It's not ringing a bell.
That was edited by Zack Soto, who edited Kaiju Max and is a DC decent comic artist in his own right, someone I follow on Twitter, but he put together a 3 or 4 issue oversized fat anthology of very good color sci-fi stories. So if you like a good anthology, I think it's just been collected. And
that's good stuff.
I'll look into it.
Dave Lapham, Xander Cannon, Justin Jordan, Dan McCade. Every issue's got decent stuff in it, and it's all quite kind of ambitious, and the covers are amazing.
Yeah, I think I missed it because I would say in probably like the last year or so, there was a time, a long time, like 20 years, where I pretty much read the Solicitation catalog cover to cover. And then in recent years, I've just been slipping. At this point, I just sort of scan through it, and so it's easy for me to miss something like that, so I'm glad you mentioned it to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's practically impossible now, though, right? I mean, the splitting, I've not paid money for previews since working in retail. I was like, why would I pay money for a catalog? But even when I lived in Spain, they had a shop copy that I could leaf through to place my order. So once a month, I'd go in, stand at the counter and go through and pick up stuff that I wanted. That was pretty neat. But at this point in time, like getting like that amount of paper and spending $5 even before you've even decided if you want anything. So I don't bother, and I can't find a decent kind of online resource that puts everything in one place. So I'm out of touch and rely on sort of secondhand info to realize there's good stuff coming. So I think I probably miss a lot more than I ever have at this point.
I will say, if you keep an eye on sites like The Bead and Bleeding Cool, they usually will do a publisher-specific roundup of all the stuff they're soliciting ahead of the actual release of the previous catalog. So that's one way to keep up with the bigger publishers. And then there's a site, First Comics, because they use the same sort of logo branding, and they may be affiliated with the Chicago company. And it's a boring site because all they have essentially are logos of whatever publisher they're discussing. But they will put everybody on there. Ahoy and Oni and the people that you know of. It's like almost every little micro publisher will get their one little blog post talking about what they've got coming up in the previews ahead of it coming out. So that's a one-stop shop if you're trying to find something like that.
Oh, that's good. Okay, that's a good steer, because I miss my checking Newsarama and getting Marvel, then getting DC and having some sort of structure to it. Whereas now those sites are all just full of multimedia stuff, and I just hate it. Can't see the wood for the trees. So
yeah, I'll
check that out.
I couldn't bother with them anymore. It was just so anyway, let's get back to Alchemy though.
Yes,
good point. Aliens Alchemy #1 was released on September 24th, 1997 per Mike's Amazing World of Comics. It ranked 113th in unit sales among Diamond Comic Distributors top 300 comics, 94th in dollar share for the $2.95 comic, with 23,695 copies reportedly sold. It ranked below the first issue of a largely forgotten Hawk and Dove miniseries, the first issue of Jeff Matsuda's Kaboom, and Vertigo's The Books of Magic #42. Alchemy #1 ranked ahead of the 9th issue of Strangers in Paradise Volume 3, and the second issues of Impulse Annual and the Inferno miniseries. This would be the Legion character, as I recall. Two X-Men titles and Spawn topped the charts. The top Dark Horse titles of the month were Star Wars Dark Force Rising #5 in 56th place, Fall of the Sith Empire #4 at 67th, X-Wing Rogue Squadron and the Empire Service #2 at 83rd, Aliens Alchemy, and Zombie World Champion of the Worms #1, rounding out the top 5 in 134th place. There was no Predator titles this month, but a Starship Troopers one-shot was released. Solicitation copy reads, Toke's a second-generation survivor, born of a transport crew that crash-landed on a deserted backwater planet. He may have discovered a means of getting off the mud ball, but he's also discovered another impediment, the deadly cargo the ship was carrying. I noticed, too, that they've got John Pound coloring Corbin on the miniseries, and of course, that's not a name you'd necessarily associate with franchise material, and we're actually going to talk about him a little bit in another Aliens project. It's interesting to have another one of these underground guys obviously getting a paycheck, piggybacking on Corbin's paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, I think of him, he was Garbage Pail Kids, right?
Maybe. I'm not super familiar with him. I know that he did a lot of underground work in the 70s. I don't know the specifics. Yeah.
I know where we're going to get to him. But yeah, I have an idea that I know the name from. I'm sure it's Garbage Pail Kids. But anyway, you crack on. Sorry.
Aliens Alchemy #2 was released on October 22nd, 1997. It slipped to 6th place among Dark Horse titles, 132nd place overall, and 119th in dollar share. It lost a bit under 3,000 readers with 20,934 copies sold. X-Men and Spawn still reigned, but the first issue of Heroes Reborn, The Return, came in 3rd, with successive issues claiming the 5th through 7th slots. The top Dark Horse titles of the month were Star Wars, Dark Force Rising #6 in 73rd, Fall of the Sith Empire #5 at 82nd, X-Wing Rogue Squadron and the Empire Service #3 at 92nd, Predator vs. Judge Dredd #1 at 117th, and Alien Resurrection #1 immediately ahead of Alchemy #2. Solicitation copy reads, It's the end of the world, and the almighty First Father hath sent a plague of aliens. Give your faith to him, or face an eternity of damnation.
Let's go ahead and get into the story now. From what you're telling me, you got into Corbin in part through Hellblazer, and then you circled back around and started seeing the appeal and collecting his stuff. stuff fairly comprehensively. How long did it take you to circle back to this miniseries? And what were your thoughts on the story?
Probably like early 2000s. And I thought it was as good an Alien story as most of them. Like, don't want to repeat myself too much, but I've mentioned that previously that for me, the Aliens films and the Aliens franchise, it's a sound enough concept that it lends itself to this kind of author or creative team realization of a story. So it really lends itself to diverse approaches. So for me, Corbin and Arcudi was perfect. I have a feeling that if you go into Aliens constantly wanting either Alien or Aliens type comics, then you're probably going to be up for disappointment. But for me, again, all of this period of Aliens comics mostly doesn't disappoint. Alchemy I love, firstly for the art, but also for some of the concepts in the story are excellent, like playing with the kind of holograms and that kind of aspect with it, kind of this throwback culture that doesn't quite understand the technology that's in front of them. And then, I think it's pretty clever.
Aliens Alchemy number 3 was released on January 2nd, 1998, over 2 months late. It actually rose a few slots to 127th place, easily outperforming the also delayed second issue of Alien Resurrection. Both titles have slipped below 20K, with Alchemy selling 19,713 copies for 115th place in dollar share. The Heroes Return debuts of Fantastic Four and Captain America topped the chart, followed by the usual X's divided by a spawn. The top Dark Horse comics of the month were Star Wars, The Last Command number 1 at 57th place, The Shadow Stalker one-shot at 77th, X-Wing Rogue Squadron and The Empire Service number 4 at 89th, Predator vs. Judge Dredd number 2 at 122nd, and the Alchemy finale closing the top 5. Solicitation copy reads, "The end of the world is at hand, an eternity of damnation awaits. But two siblings, Toke and Rachel, aren't buying into all the death and destruction. They have a hunch that salvation rests within the haunted transport ship that brought their ancestors to the planet hundreds of years ago, where there might be an alien or two along the way."
Peek behind the scenes, but we're recording a session where we're talking about a lot of different alien stuff all at once. And we're leading with this because I know this is going to be the most comprehensive thing that we talk about. There's a whole miniseries, there's a whole episode unto itself. But having read a bunch of alien stuff in a very short period of time, because, you know, I was lollygagging, so I mostly read all the stuff in the last few days. I started with the first couple of issues because I had in my head that this was a 4-issue miniseries rather than a 3. So knocking out the first two, one of the things that I did really enjoy about it is that while the alien is definitely a major motivating factor in the story, it's really not about the alien. It's really about the culture. It's about the ideological oppression and the conflict between regressive elements and progressive elements, even though realistically, if you're looking at the information, it's weird because it's almost like a pro-industry story, even though so much of it is wrapped up in ecology. And again, no major spoilers here, but essentially you have a religion that's based around a variation on the book Silent Spring, which inspired the environmental movement in the United States and I think globally in the 1970s. And so you've got these radical environmentalists, but again, they take it to such religious zeal, and because specifically they've used that ideological power as an oppressive force within their culture. And so they're painted as the bad guys. Certainly the leader of them is literally got serial killer tendencies, definitely is about bullying and oppression, but also the industry is polluting the environment that they're within under the name of, we need to make food and we need to have industries here. We need to have things that will make us to survive on this planet. We're not native to this world. We've got to do things to actually make this world livable. So it's a weird situation where largely, since so much of the story is focused on the zealotry, you kind of give the industry a pass, which is something I don't think you'd see again today. There is a subversive quality to that to even go there, though. Even in the 90s, this feels like it was a subversive element.
Yeah, and I mean, the idea about how these different groups react to a possible invading force as well feels invading force being the aliens. This kind of defensive, and I'm trying to think how to put it, how much to worry about this invading force. It feels like low-key analogy for immigration as well. Like, mm-hmm. it feels like there's a lot of politics as well as religion all over this story. I thought it was pretty great, and I think Corbin illustrates that landscape particularly well, which I also thought echoed the setting of Alien 3, like Alien 3 being in this kind of mining colony where you can't even go outside because the habitat's so harsh. It feels like the setting of this lends itself to that, you know?
I absolutely agree. I'm glad you touched on that because I didn't want to have to go back and reference Alien 3 on my own. I wanted somebody else to do it.
somebody else could talk about Alien 3.
Right. Thinking that the miniseries was 4 issues, I read those first couple of issues and then I'm like, okay, well, I'm halfway through the miniseries. This is the most substantial element. I need to maybe focus on all these little short stories. And I read all of those and then I'm coming back to Alien 3. I'm coming back to Alien Alchemy last night and realizing, oh, there was only the one issue left. I wish I'd just read the whole thing all at once. And it was weird for me because jumping in at 3 with a few days distance and a whole lot of Alien content in my brain, separating them, I was out of my depth because the third issue starts with a flashback sequence and I've forgotten what the context is. So it's almost like coming into the story, into a new story. And I really like the third issue. I like the first two issues, but I like the third issue because it really is an alien story by the third issue in a way that it's maybe not so much in the earlier issues. The alien attacks are very much in line with the movies and the franchise, but everything else, the imagery, you've got all these, again, you've got robed religious people, you've got this very desolate environment that's not windy or rainy like it normally is in the movies. This is sort of a desert environment. Things just look different. Corbin drawing this stuff just plain looks different. It doesn't look like it's of a piece with the other alien stuff that I've seen, especially recently. And so then to get to the third issue, it's almost comforting. It was like, oh, this is doing the alien stuff now. And then the way that it recontextualizes everything that I've seen before, it almost made me want me to go back and reread the miniseries with this new information. So it was a great little twist on the story, gave it new context that made me appreciate it even more. I'd liked it before, but it like jumped up a level through that last issue for me. And again, it was really well done, how I really didn't know how we got to this place. I really hadn't thought that much about it, honestly, but it managed to surprise me. And that's increasingly rare in my little alien's journey.
Yeah, that's all fair. I mean, I'm flicking through the third issue now, and yeah, aliens hanging from chains in massive cavernous spaces. I think Corbin does the things reflected in the alien's head thing better than anyone else, right?
And it's clearly a theme, and I don't know if he's just doing it because it looks cool, it definitely does, or if there's, I couldn't figure out if there was anything within the story that necessitated all the reflective surfaces, but it definitely served the whole looking cool thing. And it's especially prevalent in the first issue, where not only are people reflecting in the xenomorph skull, but you have a sequence where somebody has a knife and their own face is reflected in the knife. And there's just a lot of that throughout this miniseries where it seems like a theme. I just can't figure out if it relates to the story or it's just for effect.
No, I think I'm going to go with that's something that he just likes doing. Like he's somebody that, despite being able to do all these amazing landscapes and fantasy worlds, he's also someone who's not shy about a good close-up and playing with claustrophobic sort of panels that really draw you into like horror when he's working on horror. And I think those reflections, knives, eyeballs, and alien head lean right into that.
Well, and it's also a situation where he's very much still got that underground aesthetic. So he's not concerning overly much with representing reality. The proportions are not set in stone. Things can get a little wonky, but he can also pull off, okay, here's a hunk of metal. It's perfectly, as you would expect it to be, perfectly flat, perfectly sharp. Here's this image reflecting off of the surface. And it's a really neat contrast between this sort of earthy, gritty thing that he does elsewhere. And then you got this shimmer in the midst of it. It really makes it a stark contrast between the two. And again, it just sort of wakes you up in the process of reading the story. It's like, whoa, where'd that come from? You're not expecting that. And I appreciate that he's able to surprise me visually so often throughout the story.
It's great that in the context of a story about a character that's always like a demon kind of figure in these stories, that he manages to make the main sort of religious leader guy so grotesque, like probably like more grotesque than the alien itself. I was wondering, do you have any thoughts, like on the cover to issue 2, Corbin does this weird like mechanical sort of texture on the alien's tail and things. It echoes a panel that's inside. There's a panel inside which is the alien and somebody riding one of those sort of Stan Sakai little dinosaur things. Well, and then the cover is the same, but it's got this weird texture to it all.
Well, and not just that, but you have this sort of lizard thing coming off of it that looks like something like Mayan or Aztec. So
yes.
It alludes to that sort of religious element to the story, the faith element.
Well, I looked at that over and over, and that's just like a weird tangent. So that's like this character's riding this dinosaur and the head sticking out here, but it's actually one of the rare occasions where the colors fail because it looks like it's on the same plane as the tail. So it looks like it's coming out of the alien when actually it's just a background element. It's the same as appears inside where this figure's riding the dinosaur, but it's a slightly different layout. It just looks a bit odd, but I thought the same thing. I was like, that's a weird thing, you know? It looks like some amazing Robo Aztec Tom Strong issue 2 type design element when actually I think maybe his colors just let him down a little bit for a change.
I don't know. I mean, this guy's pretty accomplished. I think he would know because it's clear in the cover, like you said, that he's recreating an image from the book. And it could be that he did the cover first and then he redid it in the book to be like, no, sorry, here's the corrected version. I kind kind of think it's the other way around, though. I think he did it in the book, and then he wanted to do something more representational on the cover, and that's why he integrates the lizard into it, because he could have easily, like, we're seeing the saddle of this other creature, and, or no, it's not the saddle, that's, well, no, she does appear to be riding something. You can see that the female lead character is separated, and she's got shadows, and she's lit differently, and there's space underneath there where you see the grass, so it could have been very easy for him to, A, color the lizard to be more lizard-like, and B, to have more of the lizard apparent in the background, which is what he does in the drawing. But I feel like it's intentional. The coloring is so similar from the way the tail looks versus the way that the creature looks. I feel like this is an intentional thing. Either that, or maybe he just didn't like how it looked when he was trying to separate them, integrated them, and left it to us to figure out what the fuck he was doing. You know? Yeah. That might have been the plan all along. But I have to assume, because, as you say, the tail is so mechanical, and it does seem like it's something from another... It seems like something else should be there. Like see, they're on a ship or something, but they're on a grassy plane. So that doesn't make sense either. So I feel like there's an intention to that. I can't gather what the motive of that was, but I feel like it was purposeful. And one of the things I've always liked about the aliens, and one of the things that makes them unnerving for me, is that they are organic, but they're also got a weird synthetic quality to them, that metallic quality to them, that insectoid quality. There's so many different things going on with the design all at once. And I have to assume that was Giger intentionally trying to mess with people by, again, because that's what he does. It's his whole art. It's like, let me take these disparate elements that don't belong together and give you a mind fuck by putting these things together that don't belong. And it's almost like Corbin's doing the same thing, because this looks like it should be a mechanical thing that's just around, but no, it's clearly part of the alien. So I feel like he's just fucking with us, honestly.
Sure, I can go with that. I don't think he was making mistakes, and there's got to be a reason why the dinosaur head is lit exactly the same as the rest of the alien when the figure in the background is mostly in silhouette almost. But no, I mean, I love it.
Well, and also you have that softness, you've got the wrinkles in the back of the neck and everything, so there's an element there to make you see it as organic, but it's also iconic. It looks like a hieroglyph or something you would see in a temple. So is it a living thing? Is it just a representation of a living thing? Is it on the tail? Is it growing out of the tail? There's something to that, clearly, I think.
Yeah.
Because he could have very easily gone in there and done all the teeth and showed the gums and all that kind of stuff. But he actually, you know, he goes for the rounded teeth to where it looks more like it's a drawing or a sculpture than a living thing. So there's something to it, I think.
Yeah. You know, I've just had a brainwave as to where my first Corbin probably was, which is Batman Black and White. That what made me remember that is in the third issue, you got this great alien against the moon in the background looking like something very much out of like a Batman comic or something. And it just reminded me, I think that was probably my first Corbin, was that great story that he did with Jan Stranad about the like little kid gangsters and Batman in Batman Black and White, the original four issue miniseries. So that's probably my first Corbin to circle back to the very beginning. And that the main image that I remember from that, going back about 3 minutes, is the reflection of the little kid gangsters or Batman, is it, in the pool of blood on the floor from the kid who's been shot in the gang war. All comes together.
And again, all comes together in callbacks, Alien 3 again. So beyond the religious monk qualities to the people on this planet, we also have our synthetic that's been disabled, but it's still a key source of information and guidance in the babysitter character. And then obviously this wasn't intentional at the time, but because you've got a synthetic that's babysitting the only survivors of a plague and raises them from infanthood, so they're seen as paternal figures. So you've got Raised by Wolves, which is another Ridley Scott project that he did for HBO. And then you have Bishop in Alien 3. You know, you've got some weird synchronicity going on here.
Yeah, fair comment.
Overall, this ranks pretty well for you on your Aliens list.
Yeah, I'm going to say pretty close to the top. I think it's up there with Aliens Labyrinth for me. Talking about Predator Captive, probably before we spoke about this, and how that Predator Captive was basically Aliens Labyrinth as a done-in-one Predator story. Aliens Labyrinth outstays its welcome a little bit, not art-wise, I could look at the art all day, but story-wise, it felt like a bit of padding on a four-issue miniseries. Whereas I think you're right with this, with Alchemy, you're very much left wanting more. A three-issue miniseries of Corbin and Arcudi doing this stuff doesn't feel like enough.
Yeah, it is funny, especially having read so many blasted miniseries at this point. All the four issues seem like they're either a little too long or I want more and they're a little too short. You know, it's like, I want you to develop it more, or you were clearly padding it. And this one was nice and tight. I don't think there's anything that you need to cut from this. I don't think you need to add to this. This just works really well as a three-unit story. Obviously, the art's great. And speaking of the art, too, what's your page? What page do you want out of this miniseries?
I think possibly that page from issue two, the one that's emulated on the cover.
Okay.
I think that's the one that struck me most. Or failing that, the one with the alien hanging from the chains. There's a lot of great pages, and he does throwaway stuff with the scene setting, which is this stuff that he does with amazing.
Yeah, I like that shadow page a lot. The right hand page, where the brother who's in the religious sect is sort of gesturing towards the city. That was definitely one of my short list. The one I ended up going with is the same issue, but it's a little bit later. It's nothing major. It's the alien going after the barmaid, and it's just her on the page, and you see her reflected in the alien skull, and the alien's coming after her. Just because I like the drawing, I would be happy with any of the pages in here. The page with the brother was definitely one of the ones I would like to. I don't think there's any pages in this book that I would refuse, obviously. But there's just something about how he draws the female face in those three panels, her reflection in the alien, the menace in the alien's face as it's looking back at her. The lower portion with the drunken guy, I don't really care about, but those three panels just work really well for me. So of all of them, that's what I would want the most.
That's fair. Oh god, it's so good.
I'm not kicking any of these out of my collection. If I can get any of these pages, I'll take it.
I mean, he's a pricey guy to get anything by, obviously. It's amazing, like looking through this book, he's not an image guy, do you know what I mean? There's no let me make every page a winner, like a banger. They're all great in their own right, but for very quiet reasons, and a lot of time it's just because it's got cool drawings of people on it. But he doesn't do that thing of messing pages around to make them more appealing page by page. You get pages which at a glance could look quite boring compared to other pages, but there are some like genuinely amazing pages throughout. And going back to the colors, John Pound didn't color much, but he's perfectly suited for Corbin. Like, it's all quite, it reminds me a little bit of like Bjarne Hansen's colors on House of Secrets over Teddy Christensen. It's always quite sort of nauseating greens and purples and blues and things put together in a way where the overall effect is quite unsettling, like much more so than most other colorists around. If you flick through this book, it's utterly unique to look at. Ugh, happy days. I was glad to read that, and I think I might actually reread it before it goes back in the boxes.
That's another thing that was nice. It was just smooth. Even though there's a big info dump in the third issue, it just goes down smooth. You can start, there's no bog, so you can definitely easily do that.
Aliens Alchemy was never collected into a single edition in the United States, but it proved popular in France. Toth released it as an album in 2001. Then Weta Vestron offered a black and white hardcover in 2016, with a full color cardstock album following in 2018. The story was collected and cover featured by Dark Horse in 2008's Aliens Omnibus Volume 5, while Marvel Comics featured it in 2022's Aliens The Original Years Omnibus Volume 3. That edition added a new cover by the late Carlos Pacheco.
Alexa Lake, Andrew Lagan, Phyllis Byline, Billy Hines, Comics Enabler, who added, Me and Frank Talking Aliens.
I don't think there's anything we can necessarily cover in 10 minutes. Well, to be honest, Alien Stalker. what a book. But 10 minutes is probably still optimistic, because I don't have necessarily strong negative feelings about many of these, but Alien Stalker comes pretty close. What a dog.
Boom, motherfucker. At Churchy Dragon, Captain Entropy, Chris Backwoods for Beginners, Chris Dunford, Chris Lydon, Dario Rivera, Denny Kidd wrote,
David Lloyd and Mr. Hines beneath the same umbrella. Who says Mondays are unlucky? Another day in the core. I love the core. Never seen Stevens and Rizzo name checked on the same project before either. I'll have to pluck Wraith from the quarter bins next time I'm panning for gold. Seeing Aliens Lovesick, now that I have all three issues of Silicon Horizon on my shelf. That's an obscure and vapid one for your underguides. Whenever you steer under Tundra again.
No pressure. Man, it'll be a shame when y'all exhaust the DH catalog. Given where the franchise is headed, I'm not too eager to sniff around modern Aliens comics. Nobody's going to do anything interesting. Woodring's not going to guest script. Point of fact, nearly the only way Marvel could get me interested would be to plug Jordi Belair and Emma Rios into Aliens for an arc. But I'd rather get more Pretty Deadly or Redlands than another anemic Aliens retread.
Del Draxler wrote,
I am of the opinion that Wraith is irrevocably muddied and derailed by that last page reveal. I look forward to listening.
Derek W.C. of History of Comics on Film. Dirk Ashton. Ed Moore at Team Productions. Gavin Rizza, hashtag True Believer, yes. Gregory Litchfield, Hobo 613. I Was Joe Was. Julie Raoul. Kailash Swamuki, writer and media in charge. Keith G. Baker. Lamar the Revenger / Easter Bunny. Lorenzo Sweetsack, Lucretia, Maxo, Once Upon a Geek, Petrus Gaspar, Professional Wayne Sim at Living Sugar Pancakes, Grotto to the Geeky Podcast Network, Richard Field, Scott X, Seven Ecoblot, Siskoid, Superbound, and Talk Nerdy to Me.
This has been a Raw Old Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
Coming in April, Dark Horse presents Species.